Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
You are very welcome to the Ireland's Birth Stories podcast. My name is Cora Gernon. I created this space for women to share all of the details surrounding their pregnancy, labour, birth and everything in between without feeling shy about the detail. Sit back and enjoy over 100 hours of birth stories told by you, the listeners. Enjoy. Hello, I hope you've all had a great week. Just to remind you of the event that's coming up in September, so I will be launching early release tickets in July and I'll share further details of the location and who'll be speaking at the event over the next couple of weeks, but it'll be a really nice opportunity to meet past guests and also guests who are going to join me over the next couple of months, and just a nice space to sit and chat with someone who isn't afraid to share their birth story or discuss all of those details that I know many of the listeners are dying to chat about in a safe space, I suppose, safe environment, free of judgment. So this week I'm sharing a really nice episode, a really honest episode with Jess, who talks me through her three birth experiences. She did suffer two early pregnancy losses as well, which she speaks about very openly. She had an unplanned pregnancy at 20, which was a shock to both her and her family and her partner. And she, after giving birth via cesarean section, she discovered that her little girl, Georgia, had a rare genetic disorder, which she talks about in the episode. And I will link a Facebook page that Jess created to not only bring awareness to Georgia's condition, but also to share a little bit snippet of their family and their life together. She hasn't updated for a while, but she plans on doing so soon. So I'll make sure to link it in the show notes. She goes on then to talk about her early pregnancy losses and the births of her two girls, which were both positive vaginal births. One was unmedicated and the other one was with a spinal because she had failed epidurals. So other parts of the story are really important. She talks about gender disappointment, which is so real and not spoken about. She talks about the anxiety she had surrounding another unplanned pregnancy, her most recent little girl, Hannah. And she's just so honest. And I think what comes out of her mouth is so much of what we all are thinking. So I really appreciate Jess sitting down and having this conversation with me. It's a long episode, but I don't think you'll be watching the clock listening to it. I think you'll just love it. Thanks, Jess, and I hope you all have a good week. Chat to you on Monday. So would you like me to call you Jessica or Jess?
Jess.
So Jess, you are very welcome to the Ireland's Birth Stories podcast. Thank you for agreeing to chat to me in such short notice. As you said, I think it's meant to be, and the two of us are wearing olive green as well, which is the colour of Ireland's Birth Stories podcast, so I think it's all happened for a reason. So if you want to just give us a little introduction to you and your family.
Yep. So I'm Jess, I'm 29, I have a partner called Tom, and we're together 12 years. In 12 years we've had three beautiful girls. So I have Georgia, she's 8, I have Ella, who's 2.5, and Hannah, who just turned 1. We live together in a lovely little house in County Meath, and we're settled here about 5 years, and life is just going around the world as we are as well.
Yeah, I was just thinking 12 years and I was like, geez, that's ages. And I was like, oh, hold on, I'm 11.
We were babies having babies. We're quite, like, we were very young. We were 17 getting together.
Oh, cool. Yeah. So do you want to just talk to us about your first pregnancy?
Yeah. Okay. So I found out I was pregnant the summer I was 20. So it was a big shock, as it would be when you're 20. My partner was only 19 as well at the time. It was very, the first few weeks were very kind of, right, okay, you know, we spoke to parents. My parents weren't, you know, they weren't too happy. They were away on holidays when I told them, which probably was the really bad, immature move. So we spoke to both parents, and, you know, we were told you have our full support, and, you know, the talk of your support is there, your options are there, you know, just to what any parent would say to their young kids. And we decided that going forward, it's what was going to happen. And we moved back to my mum's house because I felt like that's what I needed. I needed to be at home with my parents. I was living in Tom's house at the time, and I needed that support of my mum and dad. We had our rooms, we had the space. It just worked a bit better. So we moved back home, and everything was progressing really well. We got the booking in scan for 12 weeks. And kind of from that point, life had turned around, a big U-turn. Tom's brother passed away a week before we ever got to see Georgia on the scan. So that was a huge, it was almost like a mask then, kind of all the rest of the pregnancy. It was very sad, very sudden. It was unfortunately a car accident. So that was hard for the rest of the pregnancy and those months, kind of, because we didn't know how to share our joy. But we were reassured by the family, you know, like, this is a joyous thing, you know, everybody's grieving, but that's what they need, you know, a new life comes and a new life, before, you know, that saying. So everybody rallied together to try and keep it a really good experience for us, and like that we weren't trying to hide anything, and it was just motor on. And they wanted to hear the news. Tom's parents wanted to hear the good news. Okay. They wanted to hear about the appointments, and it was just, I think, that little bit of light and hope during a tragic time, you know. So that was, those few months were really hard, and everything pregnancy wise was progressing lovely. We were so young as well, we were so naive, what to expect, you know. Like, I was really lucky that I got to live at home with my mom and dad, and they were able to guide us through. And unfortunately, the hospital that I was attending at the time, they don't offer anomaly scans. I'm pretty sure they still don't offer anomaly scans. So we decided ourselves, you know, we were more thinking, what's the baby going to be? Are we having a boy or a girl? Yeah. In the back of our mind, the anomaly scan, the health, we were like, everything will be fine. So we went and got our private gender scan, and we found out at 20 weeks we're having a little girl. And we were both over the moon. We were so happy. I always visualized myself with a girl first. I don't know why. It was just one of those things that I'd always had hoped for. So we were really happy. And from that moment, we had her name, Georgia. She was going to be Georgia. And we tried not to say it as much as I could during the pregnancy. But we had decided that's who she would be. So we carried on. From about 28 weeks, you know, we'd go in and out of the hospital then from 28 weeks, you know, every few weeks, every few months. And silly things would creep up, you know, quite common things, you know, like protein in the urine, you know, silly things like that. Blood pressure was always on the low side, but always generally really well, really good. I was consultant led due to, I think it was my BMI. So nothing serious, just, you know, due to BMI and gestational diabetes. They just wanted to be mindful of that. And yeah, everything again from 28 weeks, just, you know, every now and again they'd be like, oh, just the protein, or just watch, keep hydrated. During the pregnancy, I'd suffer really bad migraines as well. It was quite hormonal. I think that's really common as well. So I'd always be I got them with Aura. They were pretty scary to begin with, you know, where I'd get like the flashing lights and, you know, things like that. And I think at 37 weeks pregnant, I was admitted at one point because there was a few, obviously, boxes I ticked or red flags when I'd gone into the hospital. I think I was getting, I had a bit of a vomiting bug at the same time, and I was getting some contractions, but nothing they were too worried, but they just wanted to keep an eye on me. And that kind of triggered a bit of probably anxiety for me. And that's kind of where it would have began, a bit of anxiety kind of not like I was worried then that there was something going on more than I thought there was, and worrying about why, like, there would always be something going on, like protein wise or low blood pressure. Why am I getting migraines? Is there something else going on? So, like, I only had 3 weeks or so left. Again, completely naive, thought you could go overdue on your first baby. So we'd be in and out then from 3 to 7 weeks. And like birthing plan wise, I was none the wiser. I had no life experience at this point. So I was very much led by the professionals. I didn't really speak too much about what I would have preferred, because mm-hmm. I didn't know any better, really. We'd go in, we'd be told X, Y, and Z, and I'd be happy, and on we go, you know, like birth preference, epidurals, you know, whatever they recommended, I'd be happy for.
At home, had you started to create like that environment that a new baby like was coming into? So did you get the bassinet and all the lovely bits and pieces? I'm sure your family were really on board with helping create for you.
Yeah, they helped create. Again, it was that excitement as well. Mm. They would have helped create that space. We were lucky enough to be up in the attic, so we had two kind of spaces, two bedroom spaces. So my mom and dad, we had the whole space upstairs. We were very lucky we'd have the two bedrooms, and they kind of allocated that, which was a nice way to help us prepare for the baby. So I think I finished work from about 3-4 weeks, because as I said, I was in and out of hospital. So the girls I was working with at the time, they said, look, if you need to just take the time. So I finished work quite early, and I came home from work one day and they had a nursery done for me, which was so amazing. Yeah, it was really lovely. They had the cot up, the bassinet. They had everything you'd want for your new baby. You know, it was a lovely space for her to have. And then as well, a baby shower. They got to throw me a baby shower, which was, again, it wasn't really normal back then. Like 8 years ago, they weren't really common. So it was really nice just to get the two families together, because like that, we were so young. Our families wouldn't have had those kind of opportunities together. You know, like I think the Debs. And even at that, you're like, oh, you're focused, your mind is elsewhere. So it was really nice to get Tom's side of the family and my very small family together, and that was a lovely way of then me bonding with the baby as well. Because again, there wasn't, like, we'd have our space together at night time, so we were lucky to go to bed and we'd have that bond together, you know, like rub my belly, talk to my baby, you know. But it was nice then to have a place where you could visualize your baby to sleep, a place where you could visualize feeding, you know, and it was so nice that that came together. So that was a lovely way for everybody to help bond. She was the first granddaughter as well on my side of the family, so it was really nice.
Really special, yeah.
Yeah. So from, like I said, from about 37 weeks then, we were in and out of hospital, and I got to one point then when I got kept in just before, I went 10 days overdue. I was none the wiser. I thought she'd be here when she would come. And she actually, I went in at 40 weeks. And I remember the sonographer, because I'd seen the doctor every time. So I was lucky enough to get like a little mini scan, you know, the way they check to see if the baby's head's down. I remember at one point the doctor, he was just taking a bit long scanning the baby's circumference, the head circumference. And I remember like watching on the screen, very basic, a very basic machine. And he was just bringing the dial, you know, the measuring dial out. And he repeated it a few times again. And I could see like the measurements pop up and pop back down. And my mom was with me, and she's a really good advocate for her daughter, like as we all would be. Yeah. And she woke up and she was like, is everything okay, doctor? And yeah, that was no worries. Just, you know, want to get good measurements. You're going to have a big baby. And we're like, okay. So we were booked in then and there for an induction. I was hoping to go spontaneously, but unfortunately we went in the night of my 21st birthday for induction. So that was the 30th of March, 2014. And we were able to, we were booked in for 7 o'clock in the evening. So we got to spend time together, family, and off we went in. And I was really nervous because I wasn't sure what the induction, what would bring, you know, how it would progress, the pain, you know, like what would go on. And the midwives were lovely. And I remember being up in the ward, and they let my mom and my partner stay up until about 11 o'clock that night. And they're like, look, it's your first baby. Don't expect anything to happen. We're going to give you the gel, the pessary, and we're expecting probably 3 rounds to go. So don't expect much. Like, go on your way home. We lived about 35 minutes away from hospital, so I was a bit anxious leaving them. But they reassured us that, you know, everything would be fine and there'd be no progression. And I think after about an hour after they left, I felt my first kind of contractions. So I was like, oh yeah, these are feeling kind of like something I can time. And that was about 12 o'clock at night. And I remember there was a lovely lady across from me and we kind of both got chatting and it was a nice distraction for a little while. And she kind of started getting her surges around the same time. And I wasn't really aware of any sort of like hypnobirthing or any pain management or anything like that, you know, being so unsure of what I wanted to do. And I was just, you know, I'd asked for paracetamol and they came in and they're like, oh yeah, sure, we won't check you anytime soon. You know, again, you've never birthed a baby, your cervix is never dilated, everything will be fine. And I remember thinking, like, these were quite intense and I was on my own. They hadn't examined me, so there was no need for them to ring, you know, my partner or my mom. And I remember being on my own and going to the bathroom, and I thought I just needed to go for a wee, but I felt this internal pop, which then I was like, oh, that must be my waters. But I know it was my waters, but back then I hadn't a clue that it just felt like an elastic band kind of pop or ping, and then it was a coincidence that I had to go to the bathroom. After that then it became so intense. So I remember calling the midwife again and she brought me into like a triage, kind of like off the ward into another room. She's like, yeah, excuse me, you're 3 centimetres, would you like the epidural? And at that point I was like, wow, this is real. this is real. I wasn't
Where's my mom?
Yeah, where's my mom? I wasn't even aware that I could be offered epidural. And I had hoped to not go that early or that far into my journey that quick and be offered epidural. So I think I remember saying, I'd rather not. And she was like, sure, look, what's the harm? Or something along those lines. So I was like, okay, I'll go for it. Like, I'm on my own here. If it's something that will help me and the pain, we'll go with it, like, because I have no support like here with me.
Yeah.
And that was quite scary then. Like, at this point I remember this is when it kind of became a lot scary for me. We tried contacting my partner, my mom at this stage, and I think we're nearing 3 o'clock in the morning and there was no answer. They were both obviously in the land of Nod at home, and things progressed really quickly, but not in the sense of labor, but in the sense of the baby's heart rate was dropping. So they had to get a sample of blood from her head. And at this point I was 3 centimeters. They're saying I'm not progressing the way they wanted to, the baby's heart rate dropping, and the word C-section was thrown at me. And this was all happening so quickly. It was really, really, really like dramatic and traumatic all at the same time, because I didn't feel like I was in the place where I felt empowered or supported to speak for myself. Like, again, I hadn't kind of learned that way of being an advocate for myself at this point in life. And I was just going along and I was kind of like, right, I need Tom here, I need my mom here, I need somebody to come. So they gave it a while and the decision was made and they managed to finally get hold of my family. And at this point, again, I got the epidurals and things were a bit woozy, you know, adrenaline. Things were kind of, there's missing parts of the story, you know, and I always, whenever we talk about it, I always get filled in. I always learn something new. And I just remember they arrived and I was being gowned for the section. And Tom was like, what's going on? And I was like, I don't know. Like, the baby's not doing great. And it was one of those moments where my mom was stood in the hallway and they were wheeling me past her and she was shouting after a nurse, what's happening? You know, it was that quick. It was really instant. There must have been significant. They were really worried. It was significant with her and her heart rate and stuff. And I remember my mom saying that a nurse quickly stood back, said, this is what's happening. And that was it. That was the last time my mom see me again. So we were prepped C-section. And we were in and out. And I remember just my body going to shock. I remember shaking and feeling like I remember saying to them, the epidural was going too high. You know, I felt like that I was more numb than I was meant to be. But at this point, it was a spinal rather than they had to give me a spinal as well. And I just remembered the panic. It was just panic. I felt like I wasn't involved in my own situation. Does that make sense? I felt like I was looking at the situation. And Tom obviously had to wait outside before they could let him in. And as quick as it happened, like as quick as they had me in, she was born. And from that moment, I remember, you know, you're laying back and they're like, congratulations, it's a girl. And they lifted her up over the curtain. And I remember saying to Tom, there's something wrong. And they're like, there's nothing wrong. Everything's okay. And they're like, we're just giving her a bit of help. She just needs a bit of oxygen. And I was like, no, there's something wrong with her face. I can see something physically wrong. I said, the first thing that came to my mind, I was like, she's Down syndrome. I said, I feel like she's Down syndrome. I feel like there's something wrong. And I just remember crying. And these are the bits that become very hard and emotional, but like very patchy. And I just remember a nurse or a midwife coming over to me and saying, you're right, there is something. We don't know what's going on. Your baby has to go to NICU. And those moments, again, it was a haze for a very long time after that, those moments. So she went to NICU and I went into a bit of shock. So I spent a while down in the theatre, and I remember them bringing me back out, and I was kind of in and out of consciousness, you know, just with the, do you know the way after an epidural, they say you can get the shakes and everything, and that's exactly what I was getting, and the nausea. And I remember just having my eyes closed, and I remember saying to them, I just want my mom. Like, we can't bring her in. She's like, she's not gained up. And I was like, I just want my mom. And Tom had to say, can I leave? And can you just let her see her mom? And I just remember holding on to her and being like, mom, there's something wrong. Like, I don't know what's going on. And she just looked at me. She goes, I promise you, whatever's going on, it will be fine. And this is when I get really emotional. I just remember not knowing what to think. And we, at this point then, she was gone to NICU and I was brought up to the post-labour ward. She was born at 6:46 in the morning. So I remember being bright outside. But I just remember sleeping. And being in a lot of pain. I remember sleeping for a lot of the morning, and they'd come in and out and do the blood pressure checks and all those kind of things. And a nurse came in to me and I said, so like, what's wrong? Is she okay? And they were like, we don't know what's wrong. A doctor's been down, they're doing scans, they're checking everything. There will be somebody up, but you should be able to see her really soon. And again, it wasn't, you know yourself, like, they're busy. It wasn't as soon as I had hoped. The day kind of, it was almost a full 12 hours. And I was very much so in and out of consciousness, just again with the pain and being very tired. And I remember my mom still being there. My mom at this point had gone home and come back up because it was so late into the day. And I remember hearing through the foggy haze of the beeps of the machines, the blood pressure machines and the other babies on the ward. And I remember them saying, she doesn't want to go down to see her. And my mom, she said to them, you need to give her a chance. And they'd said to me, do you want to go down and see her? And I remember saying no. And I don't know why I said no at the time, but I know now I was terrified. Didn't know what to expect. I really didn't know what to expect. And they were saying, we're worried about bonding. And my mom's like, you can't be worried about bonding. It's less than 12 hours and we haven't a clue what's going on. So they were itching to get me up. And I think it was about 10 o'clock that night was when they were like, you need to get up now. We need to get you on your feet. We need to make sure you're okay. You need to see your baby. And it was one of those moments, you know, like it wasn't there was no fireworks. There wasn't that moment that you visualize or that you see when they throw the baby on your chest and it's full of joy. It was so scary. She was the biggest baby in the NICU. She was 8 pounds 4. So it was so bizarre to see that she was in this machine, in an incubator, sorry. And she was such a big baby in there. And it's funny now because you realize how healthy she was then, but not knowing the extent of what was going on. And I remember speaking to them and they just said, look, we're not sure what's going on. We know there's a syndrome, but we can't find a diagnosis. And they had mentioned to me about, like, if we can't discharge you and we don't find a diagnosis, we could potentially be talking about calling this after Georgia, something along those lines. And at that's the point again, another huge key memory or core memory here. And I was like, this doesn't happen to people like me. This doesn't happen to normal people. This doesn't happen to a young couple that never expected anything to go wrong. We never had an anomaly scan. So at that point, there was no glimpse. There was no idea of what was going on. And I just remember thinking, like, there was a sense of grief there, because when you're pregnant, you visualize this baby, you visualize how she might look, you visualize what she might look like or whose features she might get. But Georgia has a condition called craniofrontal nasal dysplasia. It's a mouthful, but it's all to do with them. So when the babies are born, their sutures, their soft spots are meant to be open, but her soft spots are closed. So she had a fusion in her skull, and she had a rare genetic condition along the side of that, which causes a few different characteristics. So she has hypertelorism in her eyes. So she's got wide set eyes. Her features aren't symmetrical compared to a typical child. So like I said, when I seen she was born, I knew straight away, because they're so physical and they're so, like, they're all facial features, you know. And she had six toes. And I know so many children are born with extra digits, but to me, for some reason, I'd never heard of that. And I was like, that's got to be related. And it is related. Like, a lot of the children are born with extra digits, but we didn't know at the time. So we ended up staying for a good 5 days. I think due to having the C-section and due to not knowing what was going on there. She was on a feeding tube for a while. She had narrow airways. At the time, they couldn't get, there was a blockage on one side of her nose. And she had a high palate. So she wasn't able to suck an atypical bottle. It was really hard for her to latch. And I had wanted to breastfeed. And again, being so young, I didn't push for that for myself. And I remember being in hospital. At one point, they had put me in a private room. I think they thought it would protect me from the other moms and babies. And they put me into a private room and said, you can stay here until Georgia comes back. And I felt the most isolated I'd ever felt. And I don't know if that's because I was in a room. There was no noise. There was no hustle and bustle. There wasn't many people coming in. And I remember a midwife in particular came in. And she's the only lady that asked if I wanted to breastfeed. And that's when I felt important, because I felt like, okay, this is something I can give to help Georgia in all this. You know, like, she was downstairs in an incubator. And I just remember thinking, okay, this is something I can give her. So I remember hand expressing, not knowing really what I was doing. We were able to give her a bit of colostrum. So that made me feel like I was involved, like I was part of, like I was her mom, you know. It made me feel some sort of connection. And unfortunately, there wasn't consistency. When we went back, Georgia came back to me actually that night, and there was no consistency with that. Like, I tried to get help, and unfortunately, there just wasn't enough help for me to kind of establish any of that or to get her to latch. Turns out anyways that she had a high palate and she had a weak suck. So we ended up having to give her special bottles in the end. So I used to beat myself up quite a lot. And I always have to remind myself, like, I tried my best. It was totally out of my control, you know. And there were so many different factors as well. So then my main goal then was to get her home. And it was a long road. That's kind of when it all began. Like, not in the operating room. It was when we got home, that's when it all began, you know. Like, that's when the hospital appointments came in. And we didn't have a diagnosis for a year. So we were left a year without any diagnosis. And it was really hard to kind of get our heads around. And I remember we were very, very early postpartum. And my mom was like, come on, let's get her out in the buggy. Let's show her off. Let's bring her out. You know, that walk, you know, the first walk. And you're like, the newborn in the buggy. And I just remember there was, again, that joy wasn't there. You know, I was more worried about people looking in and not giving me the reaction that they'd be like, oh, she's a gorgeous little girl. It was almost as if I was afraid they'd look in and be like, oh, is everything okay? And I got those comments as well. And I know that's okay now because people are curious, you know, and they want to educate themselves. But I used to put the hood up a lot, or I'd throw the muslin over the hood, and I didn't enjoy our time together as a mom and baby. Do you know that kind of way? It was really hard time, and we were living appointment by appointment because we knew we were in and out of hospital a lot. So it was never like, oh, what can we do today, or mother and baby groups, because I didn't want the confrontation. I didn't like people looking in the buggy for the questions, you know, that kind of way. And it was really hard to deal with. And I remember at 6 weeks postpartum, I remember crying. And I had kind of wrote my first, I started writing. That was like my therapy nerdy. And I just started writing one night. And I remember staying up to 3 o'clock in the morning, and I just wrote down the whole experience of the last 6 weeks. And I remember posting to Facebook because I felt like it was my explanation to the world, which was so ridiculous, because I've no explanation to give to anybody, you know, like she is who she is. And if people wanted to find out or ask, I'm an open book. That's how you educate yourself. And I remember posting this on Facebook, and it was like a moment of, I had cried so many tears, but I felt like it was like a huge weight off my shoulder because it was me addressing something. And I remember my best friend said to me, like, she was like, people have asked me, people have messaged me privately. And it was that kind of feeling of, it was so hurtful. She wasn't doing it in a way to hurt me, but it was like, people are talking about her. People are wondering what's going on. People are trying to figure out if I'm okay, but it wasn't done in the right way, you know? So going forward, I created a Facebook page called Georgia's Story. And it was my way of keeping everybody in the loop, family, friends, people that want to know, people that were just nosy, people that wanted to follow for their own, you know, enjoyment purposes, you know, to educate themselves. And going forward, that's how I kind of helped myself and my mental health. You know, it was writing and sharing pictures of her and getting the joy from that rather than hiding her, you know. And I think going to the hospital, the main children's hospital in Dublin, they have a craniofacial unit. I got to see other children at these appointments that were also typical or atypical, or had their own disabilities or had their own craniofacial problems. And it was like a world opened up to me, and I felt like we belonged somewhere. It felt like a community. And I just knew at that point that I was like, we're not alone, you know.
Not only for you, but also for Georgia as she grows. So she'll be able to, I suppose, form friendships. But it's so important for you to have those other parents to speak to, because only they can relate to, do you know, how you can guide Georgia as well.
Exactly. And it was one of those eye-opening moments. Her condition's really rare. And Facebook actually is the only, I found a support group really early on in our journey. So she's about 3 months old and we still haven't had a diagnosis, but her symptoms were so, the characteristics are very obvious. And by chance, I came across this lady that had a child with the same, it was an American page, and they had a meet to the group. And again, it was like a world, like there's about 200 of us from all across the world. And creating Georgia's Story, I was hoping one day I'd come across a family in Ireland. And that's all I wanted. My mission is just to, if I help one person today, or if I help one person doing this birth story, or if I reach out to one person, I feel like I'm doing what we're meant to do as a mum and daughter, you know, a kind of way, reaching out and opening up and guiding somebody else. You know, that's all I want to do, is be able to help someone if they're in that place that we were, because everybody has to begin somewhere, you know.
Exactly.
And so we were in and out of Temple Street, and we still are, but it was a blur. That first year postpartum was a blur. And I didn't know anything about mental health back then. It never affected me. I was really lucky. It wasn't on my doorstep. But looking back now, there were so many signs. And I used to just, it was more so brushed off because of, for trauma. You know, it was, sure, look what you're going through. Of course you're going to feel like that. But there was no acknowledgement to how I felt, you know. And I remember in the early days, I remember saying to Tom, there is something wrong. And my mom kind of was the only one at the time that was able to be honest and be like, yeah, there is, she does look different, you know, and that's fine. And going back to, remember at 6 weeks postpartum, when I posted that blog story, I remember saying to Tom that night, like, why can't you talk to me about her? And it was the first time he had, like, he made me feel valid. And he was like, there is, she does look different, but we're doing a great job. And it was like the first time that he knew that we were both on the same page, you know. And it was obvious, like, he did know there was something, but it was very hard for him as a dad. And people forget about dads sometimes. Mm. But it was his first time to say to me, there is something, but we'll be fine. And from that point, we were able to talk about it so openly. And it just became the part of our life.
I will tag Georgia's story, the Facebook page, in the podcast show notes for any of the listeners that want to have a look at Georgia's story so far. Will we move on to the next part of your story?
Yeah. So we decided then, so kind of once we got those genetic results with Georgia and we found out that we weren't carriers, it was almost like that opened a huge life for us, because we said we didn't want any more children, but a part of me, I wanted to give her a sibling. I felt if we didn't give her a sibling, or if we couldn't give her a sibling, she would wonder why. And I didn't want her to ever think that there was a reason to do, like, to do with her condition as to why. And I know that's probably so far-fetched to other people, but that's just how my mind went, you know, when we were younger. And I always was aware that we might not be able to, but it was just something at one point we'd both decided we would love to one day have another baby. And I think when Georgia was, I always said 5 would be a lovely age, because I'd given her all the time. I gave her that preschool time. I gave her that time. And to see her go to school would be such a huge milestone. A 5-year age gap, I'd have time to give another baby, you know, because I was totally aware that Georgia's life would still be great, like, busy. And we'd still have to give her our time, hospital and medically, and, you know. So I always said 5 would be lovely. So while she was in play school, we kind of decided, we were still very young, but when we were in the game, like, already, we were like, no one's going to say anything. And it was really nice to actually talk about planning, because that wasn't not in our vocabulary before, because it was an unplanned pregnancy. So it was really nice to be able to be like, to say, we would love to try for another baby. And again, we were still very young. But like I said, we were already in it. We already had a child. We were already living together at this point. We'd moved out just after Georgia's first surgery. So we were just living together years. And we just said we'd try to conceive. And from very early on, I got roped or sucked into that trying to conceive community. You know, I started hearing the words OPKs, you know, of the ovulation kits. And I started hearing about all these terms, and I got, I don't know, forums. I got sucked into these forums very early on. And unfortunately, because I'd started using all those, those kits quite early, I'd started to test quite early for, like, a missed period, you know. And you'd hear of these women, they'd cut, like, I think they call it like a pee on a sticker or a stick or a POS. POAS, pee on a sticker, the stickers. So they, like, trying to, like, any glimpse of a line before your missed period, you know, that kind of way. So I remember the first month buying pregnancy tests, and Tom was looking at me like I was mad. He's like, but you're not pregnant. And I think, but I might be, you know, like, I haven't missed a period, but I might be. And I remember doing a pregnancy test quite early on, a few days before my period, and it turned out, unfortunately, that was a chemical pregnancy. And that's when my life again, opened up into something else that I was completely, at the time, blissfully unaware of. And I was one of those statistics, I suppose, you know, at that point. And I remember it was 2018, and it was in the March. And I remember the dates and everything. It's just one of those kind of bad habits of mine. But it was that year we had the really bad snowstorm. And we were locked, like everybody's locked in their houses. It was really bad. And I just remember having this very faint positive test, or this positive test. And I remember the next day bleeding. And I remember saying to Tom, I have to go to the hospital. At this point, we were living in a completely different area. So the hospital I had Georgia in was never going to be a maternity hospital of choice again, okay. for loads of reasons. But I was more Dublin based at this point. And I believed if I was to ever have another pregnancy, I needed that 20-week scan. It was a huge factor for us. It was kind of, again, that glimpse of pregnancy loss. And I just felt like it was very, what's the word I'm looking for? It was a normal in a hospital, in a maternity surrounding like, environment. Not normal to somebody that's never had a loss, but it was normal to the staff or the terms they would have used, you know, that kind of way. And I remember even feeling so invalid, my feelings, my emotions, because as soon as you see any sort of line on a pregnancy test, you're planning, like that's a future, you know, no matter how far gone you are. I always believe that's some future, like a due date. It's something significant to you. And I felt insignificant leaving the hospital. And I remember not telling anybody, because I was like, does it mean anything? Was it actually something? And I was dismissing my own feelings because of how that little experience I had in the hospital. And I remember telling a friend, and I needed to talk to somebody at that point. And that was a nice turning point, because I was able to realize that it was valid, and it's valid to anybody, you know. And that was kind of the beginning of that journey. So I got to the point where I kind of even stopped going for a drink. We didn't have a big social life, but I remember saying, but what if I could be pregnant, or what if there's a chance, like, you know, and stopping at some city like that, or, you know, really getting engulfed into that community at such a really early stage of that journey. And I was so young, so there shouldn't have been any worries. Like, I shouldn't have been worried about anything. Yeah. But I think because we had that experience in Georgia, and I had no worries then. I had nothing to worry about then, because we didn't have anything to be worried of. But when your eyes are opened to what, like, there is so much in life that we don't know. And I think when you've already been open to something like that, or that wouldn't happen to me, and that's happened to you, your mind changes completely. So that was fine. We booked a holiday. I kind of decided then, come the summer, I needed to relax, because Tom obviously wasn't involved in that side of things. But I needed to relax, because it just became that topic of conversation. It was something that I talked about quite a lot, and I needed to just relax. And we went away on holidays, and we came back from holidays, and of course the first thing I wanted to do was go and use a pregnancy test, because I had a few symptoms when we were away. I remember crying on the airplane going home from, we were in Fuerteventura, it was our first family holiday, and I remember crying on the plane, and I was like, I'm so emotional, it was such a beautiful holiday, and I was like, oh my god, I'm pregnant. it was that moment, and I was like, I am pregnant. I am pregnant. I'm crying leaving holidays because I had such a beautiful time. It was just one of those moments. And again, unfortunately, I started doing the testing again, and at this point I did have a missed period, and the Lyme progression, again, it was a term that I had picked up along the way. There was just something, I felt something was off. I felt like I was ovulating. I was getting quite really bad pains on one side of the pains from quite early on. And there, the lines, like every pregnancy test I've taken, like the lines would be different colours. They wouldn't be, like one day it'd be really dark or it'd be really light. And I was like, Tom, there's something wrong. And you know when that gut instinct kicks in and you just know something's wrong. Mm-hmm. And I remember I should have been 6 weeks pregnant, and I remember I was going to Slimworld at the time. I remember standing up and I felt just a gush of blood, and I just knew. And I said to Tom, okay, after the experience we had back in March, I don't want to go to the hospital and feel completely invalid and, you know, invalid. So I'm going to go to Tesco's and get a test. And if it still says I'm pregnant, I'm pregnant, but I'm going to go to the hospital because I don't think it's normal to bleed. And he was like, okay, that's fine. Like, if that's what you want to do, if that helps you. And it was a really stormy night. It was October. And my mom drove up to the hospital. And she said, look, I'll wait. This is pre-COVID. So she was allowed to wait. And she came into the waiting room and they brought me in. And because at that point I was really early, they'd done an internal scan. And again, it was one of those moments where I just knew. And there was a lot of blood. And they'd said to me they couldn't find a baby in my uterus. It was a pregnancy of a known location. So they had to treat it as an ectopic pregnancy. So that was another huge traumatic event that it really affected me in so many ways. So I got kept in overnight and they'd done all the necessary tests and they still couldn't find the baby in my uterus and they couldn't find a baby in my fallopian tubes. So they said to me, look, there's a few different roads we can go down. There's expectant management where your body seems to be miscarrying already. So we can just let your body do what it needs to do, or there is surgical management or medical management. So they could have done a surgery in a few days' time to see where I'm at, or they'd give me an injection to kind of terminate any of the cell, like any of the HCG, anything that was going on. So we decided, because we didn't really know what was going on, and we were going to treat it with expectant management. And I was to go back in every 48 hours to get my bloods done.
So out of my two children, Eva is naturally the most curious. She's in at everything. She wants to see what's in every press. She wants to see how every toy works. Is just into everything. And although it's just a new way of parenting that I didn't have with Oliver, I just had to be prepared for this child who needs constantly, who's being stimulated constantly. So say hello to Brain Building with PandaCrate. It's exactly what I needed. It's a subscription service for play essentials designed just for babies and toddlers aged 0 to 24 months. It's created by play experts at KiwiCo in partnership with Seattle Children's Hospital. PandaCrate is thoughtfully designed with care to stimulate your baby's brain development through play. PandaCrate is a science-backed, research-based approach to play and recognises that there's more to babyhood than the milestones itself. So within the PandaCrate, there was lacing beads. So Eva can sit down and do something like a jigsaw, but she'll have it done really quickly. And with the lacing beads, it takes her just a couple of minutes and she has to use both hands so she can really explore each piece, thread the shapes onto a string and develop bilateral coordination. Really, really handy. And also there's a peg puzzle. So it's another way to solve shapes, and it's nice. They're nice wooden, robust toys. They're easy to clean, nice solid shapes. And I find the other toys that you put, for her anyway, to put say a block into something is far too easy. So the peg puzzle was just really handy. It challenged her a little bit more than the others. Whether you're a first-time parent or not, PandaCrate provides a way to simplify the early years with just right products to support your baby's rapid development in the first 2 years of life. Countless hours go into creating the playthings in this box. KiwiCo designers.
Hey folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently. Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ideate, iterate, and prototype, test, review, and revise. And then they do it all again. So every material, colour, angle, and curve is a thoughtful choice designed to stimulate your baby's brain development through play. And as I mentioned before, you can really see that in, especially with the pieces in the Peg puzzle. Unlock brain-building play and create a foundation for early learning with PandaCrate from KiwiCo. Get 30% off your first month plus free shipping with code IOREBIRTH at kiwico.com. That's 30% off your first month at kiwico.com with promo code IOREBIRTH. On to the rest of this week's episode.
And that was, I started journaling at this point again. So it was another thing that came back around in my life, was writing down. It's the way I kind of cope. And I remember just writing down, I still have a book actually of all my ovulation tests, and it was just a way to kind of, I'm glad I have it now because it marks every part of my journey. Mm-hmm. And I was just writing down, I'd get the phone call from the nurse and I'd write down what my numbers were, my HCG, if they were going up, if they were going down. And I remember the day it hit zero and I remember bawling my eyes out because I remember thinking, for something I wanted so bad, I've never been so relieved to see a number that meant I'm not pregnant, because that journey, it was a long 2 weeks. And I was lucky, that word is so bizarre to use, but I was lucky it had gone the way it had, because so many women aren't fortunate enough for their body to do it that way. You know, there's surgeries and there's so many other situations. And yeah, I remember using that word lucky and being like, that's so crazy I'm using that word, but I was so happy to have my body back and to get over and just to move on. And I remember receiving my 12-week scan appointment. You know, those silly things like that really hit that gut, you know, that gut feeling we were talking about, that blow. And I remember receiving that. And then I received like a letter to say, like, here's information. We're sorry for your loss. There's a remembrance service day every year this month. And I kept all those things. And I don't know if it was my way of coping, but I only came across them the other day. I said, I need to let go of that hospital. I don't have a baby, but I kept all those things. And because they're significant to me now, you know, it just shows what we went through. And we finally got over the other side where I wasn't under the EPAU anymore. We're not getting any more appointments through for that pregnancy. Like, I had to do those horrible phone calls, ringing my GP to say I'm not pregnant anymore. We'd gotten over that side of that journey and that we were able to move on. And it was Christmas time and I said, I'm not trying anymore. I said, I'm not trying. I'm going to enjoy Christmas. I'm going to have a few drinks. And guess what happened? I became pregnant. And that's how little Miss Ella came to life. So I found out on New Year's Eve that year that I was pregnant again. And That pregnancy with her was a lovely pregnancy. I'd set those intentions out years and years ago, thought my next pregnancy was going to be planned. And I'm going to be more educated on what I wanted. I'm going to breastfeed. And I really set out those intentions so many times. And I believe that my mind frame and the support around me at this point, because everybody was so excited for Georgia to be big sister. Everybody's mm-hmm. so excited to see us have a normal baby, like a normal labor, a normal experience. We got to leave the hospital and never go back again for other reasons, you know?
Yeah.
And the support was so lovely. The families all really rallied together. And it was a really celebrated pregnancy, you know? And I had my lovely, I was under a consultant, mainly because of what had happened. And I had gestational diabetes as well. So I was meant to be under consultant then anyways. And we were just so lucky at my 12-week appointment, my 12-week scan, everything was happy and healthy. And I'd made sure I had said to them so many times, this is what happened. This is like going forward. We need anomaly scans. We need this. We need that. I need to check their face. I need to check their heart. I need to check. And I was so lucky with the doctor I had, a professor in fetal medicine. He really looked after me. And I had numerous anomaly scans from about 16 weeks. So like the care was next, you know, it was just an amazing experience and what I should have had really from the beginning. And it just makes me sad that there's still that's still going on in hospitals in Ireland. There's still no 12-week scans, you know, and there's still many parents going through what we had. And I just believe if you have those tools early on in pregnancy, you can deal with that situation so much better.
Yeah,
your mind physically, because I remember people saying to me, well, what would have changed if you had have known about Jordan? And I said, well, so much would have changed. We would have had a different, totally different outlook. We would have had knowledge, a huge factor, you know. Knowledge is key in these situations. We would have been prepared mentally, physically, to what, to our own degree, like to where we could be on our own terms, and we would have processed it, you know. So that was a huge factor, and we got all that. We got the validation, we got the all clear, and I was able to say, I'm older, I'm wiser, this is what I want. I was going in by, like, as a woman, as an adult, you know, this time I wasn't going in holding my mom's hand. I was going in speaking for myself. So we were able to, I was under the VBAC clinic, which was great, because I knew, again, I had all these years of being able to read up on different things, you know, different opportunities, and being in different forums then, you know, you teach yourself these things. And I knew I wanted spontaneous labor. I didn't want to be induced, to what you're in control of. I knew I could control certain things. And I was able to go on to like support groups for VBACs. There's a brilliant one in it for Ireland. And just talk to like women that have gone through the same thing. And I was able to go into the hospitals and be like, at 38 weeks, Georgia was starting junior infants. And I'd said, I don't want this baby to come early because I want to enjoy the first few weeks of Georgia starting school, because the baby was due on the 11th September. So I was like, no, I need those 2 weeks. We need to settle together. This is a huge point in life. We need to really enjoy those moments. Again, set those intentions. And I was like, I will happily go overdue again. I want this baby to come spontaneously. So everybody thought I was mad, but on my 38 week appointment, I refused to sweep. I remember ringing my friend. She's like, you did what? And I said, yeah, I refuse to sweep. I don't have to do what they want me to do. You know, I don't have to. I can speak for myself now. We have a choice. Women have a choice, you know. Mm-hmm. And I refused to sweep. And I went 6 days overdue. And I was happy. And we were all so happy. We were in this bubble of new skill and new routine. And when I was 40 weeks and 3 days, I actually got admitted. I just felt she wasn't moving. You know, they say, like, their kicks count is I'm a huge advocate for that as well. And I don't believe, you know, they say they go a bit quieter before the due date. They just move different. So I remember thinking, she's not moving quite the same. So we went into the hospital and they agreed that she wasn't giving them what they wanted. So I got admitted. She was fine, but she was just a bit sleepy, maybe. She just wasn't doing what they needed her to do. So I was actually admitted, and in the hospital I was getting quite regular contractions, but they weren't progressing in pain wise, but they could see them on the monitor. I'd stayed in overnight, and the next day they'd said, we're going to let you go home tonight. We're happy with how she is. Look, you want to go spontaneously, and we really like you're only they did an examination, and I was dilated to 2, and they said you don't have to stay in, but like there was a few requirements having a VBAC. So as soon as I started getting regular contractions and painful contractions, you have to go in to get the continuous monitoring, which was huge back then. So to make sure that the risk of uterine rupture was, you know, that's one of the risks of having a VBAC. And I was like, okay, that's fine. So they done a stretch and sweep that night. And I remember going home. I'd never experienced any of this with Georgia because I was induced. So I never lost a plug. Didn't know what a mucus plug was. And I remember going home that night, and I had a bath, and I had some lavender burning, and it was really just that dreamy kind of visualization, trying to relax and being like, this is going to happen naturally. I have the right environment around me. And it was just so dreamy. And I remember I got Tom to take a picture because I just wanted to focus on that moment. And then I have it forever then, you know. And like clockwork after, so we got discharged quite late that night, and I got after I had that bath, I lost my mucus plug. I lost my show, and I remember thinking, oh my god, I've never experienced anything like this. And it was, I just remember being disgusted but truly intrigued at this all at once.
Yeah, I get it. Yeah.
I'm going into too much information, but I remember being like, what is this? And again, rang my mom, and she was like, yeah, it sounds like your show. And I was like, okay, so what's going to happen? She goes, well, it could be days, you know. I was like, what are the chances? I'm 4+5 now. And she was like, look, we'll just see how you go. So I managed to go to sleep, and about 5 o'clock that morning I woke up, and I just knew, like, today's the day, this is it. And I woke up to just like period like cramps, because again, I'd never experienced any of this process. It was totally new to me. And I just kind of was in and out of sleep from 5 o'clock, and I got to 8 o'clock in the morning, and I was up, and I said, Tom, you're not going to work today. And he's like, oh, I was like, you're not going to work. I'm having the baby. And he was like, are you sure? And I was like, yeah, I've been having pain since 5, and I lost my show. Like, so that's a huge indicator. And he was like, right, like, I don't know if it was like an instinct, but it was like panic stations for him. And he was like, the only way I could describe him was like a headless chicken. He started running around, and Georgia, come on. And I was like, calm down. Like, we have a few hours, calm down. And he was like, but what's happening? Are you in pain? I was like, yeah, but like, we're managing. It's fine. I'm going to get a shower. And he was like, a shower? Why are you getting a shower?
You're in labor.
Yeah. I think every mom gets this, or anybody that has labored will understand this. You just need a shower sometimes.
Yeah.
And that was one of my requirements, was I need a shower. So he brought George to school, and it worked out perfectly because it was like 9 o'clock, and I knew she was safe. I knew she was in school, and we had a plan of action. You know, we knew who was collecting her. So it couldn't have happened at any better time. And after being away for the 2 nights from her, I was so happy I got that one extra night home before she became a big sister, because that's a huge transition. No one talks about those transitions emotionally, and going from one to two, from 1 to 2 is a huge emotional transition for us, I think, as parents, because you're hugging them and you're like, you're not going to be the baby anymore, and no matter what age they are. And I got that last night with her, so I was happy. So we got to the hospital at about 12 o'clock, and I was getting regular contractions, and they're like, yep, you're 3 centimeters, we're going to admit you. So I was so happy. I was really happy. And we went straight up to, not delivery, but we were kind of in, it was off delivery suite. It's a room where they pop you in before you're ready to go into the delivery room. We were in the delivery suite, and we were just there, and it was so relaxed. I had food there. I got dinner, and I was so happy. Just bouncing on the ball, hooked up. That was the only kind of down point, was that I was still hooked up to this machine because of the continuous monitoring. So every now and again, they'd be like, oh, you have to change position and stuff like that. And I could feel the intensity of the contractions really coming, the surges that they speak of. And the midwife said, we're doing an examination. And she went to say, you're still 3 centimetres. And then my waters just went everywhere. Like she, it was one of those moments where I was having a contraction while she was doing an examination and she didn't burst them. They just went naturally. And it was like something you see in a movie or you'd hear women talk about. It just went everywhere, like a tsunami. And I was like, oh my God, was that my waters? And she's like, it's okay. And that's, I think, the first point where I started to panic because I felt like this is out of my control now. And I was like, no. She said, I went from 3 to 4. Once my waters went, though the waters were bulging, so they were kind of stopping anything from progressing. So off to the room, the labour room. And that was about 4 o'clock in the evening. And between 4 and 9 o'clock, things kind of became a bit of a blur then at this point. I remember they kept saying to me, you know, just to move onto your side, the left side, you know, when they want to get their baby's heart rate a bit better. And it kept happening a bit too much where they were like, okay, the heart rate, like she's not really happy in that position, you know, turn on that position. And when you're labouring, you kind of want that free movement. You want to be able to kind of just do what your body wants. And when you're laying on a bed and you have a monitor on you, it's not a nice experience because you can't get into that like optimal position that your body is telling you to get in. And I remember them saying to me, like I was able to get up again at this point and my waters were kind of tinged colour that they weren't too happy with. The baby, she was doing okay, but they were to say there's a little bit of a tinge, which is a sign that she might be in stress or that like she's on a poo. So again, I've no concept of time. It kind of was a bit of a blur. But they were like, do you want the epidural? And I remember saying yes. So I was about 5 centimetres at this point. And they're like, okay, we'll get you the epidural and see if things kind of, if everything is okay, we'll keep going the way we are. And so I got the epidural and it failed twice. And I was like, no, this can't be happening. This is when the panic set in for me because I was like, I got to that point of 5 to 6 centimetres and I felt so empowered that I got to that point because I'd always said, I'll try what I can because you don't get an extra medal at the end. You know, kind of way, if you don't get your pain relief or if you decide not to, but you can feel empowered and that's so amazing in itself. And I had felt really empowered. And when I said, you know what, I'm tired. There's no harm. Like that's what it's there for. Like it's amazing medicine, you know? So I was like, yeah, I'd like the epidural. And when I got to that point when it failed, that's when I was like, I felt like it was just out of my control. And I was like, I want help and I can't get the help I want, you know? And that's where the panic set in for me because you're craving this help and you want this like break because they were so intense. Like once the waters went, they were so intense, the contractions. And I remember saying, like, what are we going to do? And they're like, it's fine. And with that, they said, right, we'll give you spinal because we need you to get this. Like, you need that break. You need help. So they gave me a spinal. And with that, Tom decided at that moment of time, he's like, oh, my God, the car park closes. I have to get the van out of the car park. So he decided at this point that he needed to leave to go and save his car. And move it from the car park because he would have been stuck in this multi-story car park all night. So they're like, she's fine now. She's had the spinal. But of course, typical, as soon as he left, my blood pressure dropped really low and I kind of blacked out.
Okay.
And I just remember, yeah, I remember waking up because my blood pressure dropped so low. I remember then waking up to them. I can't remember, so correct me if I'm wrong or if I'm wrong, apologies. But they were squeezing a blood pressure bag, I think they called it. They're squeezed to get my, I'm not sure what it was. I just remember this. They're squeezing some sort of bag of fluids or something to get my blood pressure back up. And that was really scary. Again, I felt like these incidents happen when I'm on my own. And it's when you feel the most vulnerable, you know. And I remember being so upset because I just kind of blacked out. Things just went completely black. And I'm waking up to this situation. And I'm like, where is everybody? Where's Tom? Where's my mom? And my mom was never there from the beginning. But it was just one of those moments where you get an awful fright. And he came back. And at this point, they'd stabilised me. The baby was fine. And I was laying there. And he was like, is everything okay? Because he walked into this atmosphere. And they were like, no, everything's not okay. It is now. But why did you find that the most appropriate time to go and move your van? And he was like, okay, I will be. That's it. I'm here.
I'm here. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm here. I'm fully like here, present. And from that point then, my pain had stopped. They stabilized the baby. They were still happy that she wasn't in distress. And I have to say then, from that moment, it was again, I just felt like I'd come back to myself. Everybody, the atmosphere had completely changed. The doctors had all left that came in, you know, at that moment. Mm. And it was just me and this midwife. And she'd said, I mean, Tom, and she'd said, would you like us to turn the lights off? It's the evening time now. And we got the lights dimmed. And she was like, okay, you're fully dilated. You're 9 centimetres. But we'll give you, like, there's no rush. We'll give you a half an hour and we'll start pushing. And that was just lovely to have a normal conversation without something going wrong or, like, you know, being in pain and being able to talk. And we got to talk and we got to bond with the midwife. Because, you know, in between all this, there's so many people coming in and out. There's different midwives. There's shift changes going on. And it got to 10 o'clock and she was like, okay, are you ready to push? So we got to the stage of pushing. And it just wasn't happening like they wanted to happen. And again, I heard that heart rate monitor go down, like the heart rate started to go down again. So they'd said to me, look, we're going to have to intervene. We're going to do forceps. And at this point, again, I'd already, I said I didn't want any intervention, but I was like, no, if that's what you need to do to get her out, that's fine. So a few stitches or a few pushes and they got her out with forceps and I had an episiotomy and she was born a healthy 9 pounds 4 ounces and she came into the world screaming. And like that, I just remember asking them, how many toes does she have? And to me, it was just one of those valid questions because with Georgia, it's what I had noticed. Is she okay? How many toes does she have? And they were kind of looking at me like, why are you asking? And Tom was like, there's a reason why she's asking. And I got to hold her. I got to do skin to skin. When she kind of came off the table after having like just a quick intervention, you know, after having the forceps. And I got to latch her. And our breastfeeding journey lasted until she was, yeah, we got to latch. And our breastfeeding journey lasted until I was 9 months pregnant on Hannah.
Oh, wow.
And it was just a totally different experience. And those postpartum days are full of hormones and the mom guilt is real. And I had a lot of mom guilt because I felt like I'd bonded so differently with Ella than I did Georgia. Mm. And it's your mind can like sway so quickly, can't it? Especially postpartum. And I was all about keeping on top of my mental health. Because like that, I just dipped into kind of depression after George was born and just keeping on top of it. And I went to kind of counseling like in between the miscarriages and during the pregnancy and everything was fine. I had a really, really good postpartum experience. Just not like the baby blues. And we established breastfeeding really well. And like I said, we'd done it up until she was 18 months old. And that's how Ella became Earthside. So it was a totally different experience.
So will we talk about your most recent experience?
Yeah. So we fell pregnant with Hannah. This was an unplanned pregnancy. And I was 9 months postpartum with Ella. So it was a really, really difficult time. Again, it was one of those experiences where completely different feeling to how I was with Georgia. Even Georgia was unplanned. This time around, I was so content with two children. I really took it hard. We were in the height of lockdown as well. Life was so different. And I just said, like, I felt like after having Ella, I felt I was so lucky. I felt like if I had any more children, I was kind of like not asking for something to go wrong, but I was just very lucky. Like I had all my eggs in one basket. Do you know that kind of way? I just felt so happy. And I was like, I remember finding out I was pregnant and my periods still weren't regular because she was only nine months postpartum.
Yeah, of course.
9 months old and the breastfeeding. I thought I knew my body. I thought I knew how my body worked at the time. Well, they were so, so irregular. And this it kind of caught me off guard at how upset I was. I remember using the word, it's quite sensitive, but I remember using the word, a inconvenience. And I remember just people trying to validate. I remember my best friend at the time saying, what's inconvenience, the baby or how your life's going to change? And I remember saying to her, everything.
Everything, yeah.
And I found it was quite a dark place, in the sense of it took a long time to come around, because at this point, I know with Georgia, everybody said, you know what your options are. But at this point, life in Ireland had changed. These referendums had come in, you know, and there really is an option for women now to go ahead with anything, you know, like that termination wise. And I remember getting to the point where I actually rang a clinic for myself without telling anybody. And I remember just my mum and my sister then knew, and they were like, you need to do what you need to do. And at the end of the day, that's it. Like, we give you our full support no matter what you choose. And Tom, I remember speaking with Tom, and obviously he was very much so like, I will support you, whatever you want to do, but you can do this. You can do this. You will be fine. We will be fine. And I remember thinking so silly things like, we need a bigger car. And like, with going from a family of 4 to 5, that dynamic really changes, you know, the car, for example, because we're going to have 2 babies in big car seats. We're rear facing, you know, we're going to need 3 car seats to go across a car, and city things like that. And our housing situation wasn't great. It was going to become overcrowded at this point. And it took a long time to move on. And my 12-week scan was on Ella's first birthday. So I took that as like a bittersweet moment, a moment of kind of like hope and everything would be okay. And a moment of, I can't believe I'm leaving her at 7 o'clock in the morning on her birthday. But it was a lovely experience. Everything was fine, and there was a 12-week baby flicking away on the monitor.
Did that change things for you when you saw her?
I think so. It made it very real. And at the same time, I had the support of my sister-in-law. She also was experiencing unplanned pregnancy. We were only 3.5 weeks apart. So I had that support. And I always say to her, if I didn't have her throughout the pregnancy, I think my mind frame would have been so different, because I knew how I was feeling was so valid.
Yeah.
Because people don't talk about unplanned pregnancies, really.
No, I completely agree. Yeah, they don't.
Yeah, they don't. Not to the extent of how I felt and how my sister-in-law felt. And it was nice to know that I could just ring her sobbing my heart out, and she'd be like, this is okay. We will be okay. I'm feeling the exact same. So it did change how I'd seen her on scan, and being back in the rotunda, I suppose, so short, or the hospital being so short, the time frame between babies, it was kind of nice to see the familiar faces, you know. Yeah. There was midwives that I'd come across. So I was straight back under consultant again, gestational diabetes. They just treated me as the same. And I found out then we got our anomaly scans, and again they treated us with so much care because of Georgia, even though we know it wasn't genetic. Every time they're like, no, there's always a chance. So we got great care in that sense. And we weren't going to find out, because I said I've had too many surprises this year. So we're like, we leave our third as a surprise. And we didn't in the end, because I said, you know what, I need to know, because if we're having a girl, I'd already started giving away things before I found out I was pregnant. And
right.
We needed to keep financially. We needed to keep all those bits. And we needed to keep our clothes, because the babies were going to be not like 18 months between them. So we found out we were having a little girl. And I'd gone from dealing with those emotions at the beginning, to seeing the 12-week scan, to being in a lovely bubble, and then found out we were having another girl. And I felt like I disappointed everybody. I felt like everybody wanted us to have a boy because we had 2 girls. And I felt like they were like, oh, wouldn't it be lovely if you had a boy? Wouldn't it be great if you have Tom, his son? You know, all these comments. And I remember thinking my sister-in-law had a little girl after 2 boys. So I was like, it would be great if we had a little boy after 2 girls. But I kept convincing myself and reminding myself, no, a girl would be fantastic because we have all the necessary clothes and equipment and everything there. And I remember just feeling a feeling of deflation, and I didn't realise it was normal. And I remember crying. We'd done the balloon pop, and everybody was so happy and excited, and they showed us like support. And I remember leaving after that and saying to Tom, "Why am I sad? I have a baby in my arms. I have an 8-year-old, or nearly an 8-year-old, laying in bed. They're all healthy and happy. Why am I sad? This isn't normal. Like I should be grateful. Like not many women. Like I've had 2 miscarriages. There's women out there that haven't got to the point where I have. Why am I so selfish?" And I was just couldn't get my head around it. And I'd gone back to counselling again because I felt like if any pregnancies, I needed the support mentally for this one because of how it had began. And I remember saying to the therapist, I'd actually gotten linked with the mental health team in the hospital, which was fantastic. And I remember saying to her, like, all these feelings. And she was like, "You know those feelings you're having? They're normal. Like, that's totally normal. You have a visualization of how you might want it to be. The gender disappointment is really real.
Yeah,
like you can expect." And again, that's another subject that you don't see people talk about because you're expected to just love what you're given. And I remember just crying. And yeah, it was. I remember that sentence so well, saying, "I have a baby in my arms. Why am I not happy?" And that was kind of a moment for me as well when I realized I needed to keep on top of my mental health because it can spiral so quickly, especially with hormones and stuff like that. So it took a good while. It took a long time because I'd said, "I'm not having an unplanned pregnancy again. We've 3 babies now. I won't be having any more children." So it took a long time for me to accept that we're having 3 girls. And I just have to keep going back to, "She's healthy. We have clothes, we're saving so much money." And I started the names. I started with the names to try and bond, you know, trying like writing down your list in the evenings, going through names and doing all those kind of things. And it got better. It did get better, you know, like Christmas came. Christmas came around and we got to celebrate Christmas again. And I was like 28 weeks pregnant around Christmas. And it followed the same pattern as it did with Georgia. I would have fallen pregnant around the same time. So it was another March baby. So it was so nice then to be like, "Oh, I remember when I was this far gone with Georgia. I remember."
Yeah.
So those kind of experiences were lovely. And then I knew after Christmas, those 12 weeks after Christmas, to fly in. Like once you hit 28 weeks, it flies in. So my sister-in-law was due to have her baby soon and she had her baby. And that was really a lovely point because I was able to see this little girl and be like, "I can't wait for my little girl again," you know. And I just remember I kept saying to myself, "How lucky am I to say I have 3 girls?" Like, not like that, not many people could say they have 1 girl, but I could say I have 3 girls. And you know, those simple affirmations. So I decided to kind of really change my mind frame, and I'd never done hypnobirthing before. So again, I got into that mind frame of, "No, like I can set this, I can put the intentions out there. I'm having another spontaneous labour. I don't want to be induced. I want a lovely experience." And yeah, just done the hypnobirthing in the evenings, listening to it. I'd fall asleep to it. I kind of really got into like my essential oils, you know, just calming, just meditating, trying to really get my head into the right mind frame because I was busy. And it's only now when you can actually look back. I was still breastfeeding a baby. She was a baby. I had a child going to school and yeah, I was heavily pregnant chasing after like a 17-month-old, you know.
Yeah.
And you don't get help unless you ask for help. And I wasn't great at the time for asking for help, you know. And I got to the point where I said, "I've decided I'm not going to tandem feed. It's just something I want to do to protect my mind." That transition when you wean is so hard. So that was a huge hormonal blip in the whole process. So I'd actually night weaned her when I was about 5 months pregnant because I needed the full night's sleep. And yeah, when I was 9 months pregnant, just the beginning of the 9th month, so I had 4 weeks left, I'd said to Tom, "We need to, I'm ready to night wean her." But you don't realize you're like, when it's done, you're like, "I wasn't ready." And then comes the emotions and the tears. Yeah. And I still have like the last feed. I have a picture of our last feed, unknowingly, it'd be our last feed. And I gave those 4 weeks to myself. I tried my best to give those 4 weeks back to me because I'd done 18 months of pregnancies. But before that, the miscarriages, the pregnancies, the breastfeeding. And it was a lovely transition. Again, I still cried, like, you know, yourself, the hormones and everything. But it was a positive experience. And again, everything was going well. The pregnancy was going great. They were saying to me, oh, it's another big baby. I was only expecting another big baby because I'd gone from 8-4 to 9-4. Mm-hmm. And they're like, you're going to have a big baby. And again, I tried to stick with what I knew. And I knew that I had an opinion or I had a voice. And I'd say to them, oh, well, I've birthed a big baby before. So I'm well capable of birthing another big baby. And they'd bring me in for extra growth scans at like 38 weeks. And they were like, oh, we talk about induction or we talk about C-section days. And I was like, no, that's not a vocabulary in my mind. I don't want those. I'd rather just go into spontaneous labor. And again, I refused the sweep until I was overdue because I was like, they either can work in your favor or they can just make you feel wrong for a few days. And again, we were in a big lockdown. So from the January to March, the kids were out of school. So I was like, you know what? I'd rather just get Georgia back to school. And she'd already had so much time, like from junior infants out of school. Just want to get Georgia back to school and I'll concentrate on the baby. And I think she went back to school when I was 39 weeks pregnant. And I had at 40 weeks and 5 days, I had an appointment. And they said, would you like a sweep? And I said, I feel content enough. Yeah, like if I'm favourable, that's cool. I'm happy with that. So they were like, yeah, you're favourable to have a sweep. Just kind of let my body kind of do what it needs to do. There wasn't much going on. And then the next day, I got George at school. I had Ella at home with me. And I remember just hoovering or mopping or doing one of those things. And I had the sensation of, I know I felt this before and it was my show again. I lost my show. And again, the same feelings of, this is just crazy. It's so bizarre. And at this point, I had no contraction or anything. And I rang Tom and he's working within Dublin. He just made sure he was based in Dublin. And I was like, look, nothing really to report, but I lost my show. And he's like, okay, no problem. It was my dad's birthday as well. So I was like, oh, sure, what are the chances they're going to share birthdays? You know, I'll go down to my mom's, have a bit of cake and everything. So we done that. And then I remember I had all the cramps and aches that normal pregnancy bring. You know, I had the, I don't know if you ever heard of the term lightning crotch, you know, the
show. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I had all those. But I didn't think anything different because I was carrying a child on my hip, like a toddler as well. I was doing it, you know, you just do it. And we got to bedtime and I always said, again, once they were in bed and asleep, I'd be so happy for anything to happen during the night because, you know, your kids are safe and they're well and they're being looked after. And we were actually transitioning Ella into, she was very young, but it worked. We transitioned her into her cot bed and we brought her into George's room. So they were actually... We were doing that and they were laying on the mattresses for a while on the floor to two of them and it was great crack. They really enjoyed it together. And I remember laying down on the mattress with them and we just bashed Georgia and I squeezed her hand and she's like, why are you squeezing my hand? And I was like, am I? I didn't even realize it was. And it kind of occurred to me, I was like, I'm getting pains here. I'm getting tightens. And she got to see pretty quickly, but she kind of triggered it. Kind of, she copped that something was on. She's like, mom, are you okay? And she'd panic. She'd worry. So I just reassured her that everything was fine. And that was about 8 o'clock. And at 9 o'clock, I rang my friend. And I was like, I think I'm getting contractions. And she's like, look, we're on the phone. We'll time them. And I think that was at 9 o'clock on the button. And by 24 minutes past nine, I had 5 contractions.
Okay.
And she's like, yeah, I think you're in labor. So I was like, grand, I'll keep you updated. I'll ring my mom. So I rang my mom again, another kind of distraction on the phone. And in that time between 9:30 and 10, they'd even gotten more regular and they were lasting a minute. And she was like, I think you need to, like, you're kind of, I started to hesitate during them, you know, that kind of delayed speech or that delayed conversation. And I was like, wow, in an hour, they've kind of progressed really quickly. And again, because of the continuous monitoring after having cesarean, they kind of want you to pop in quite soon. So I remember at 10 to 10, we rang Tom's mom to come over. And by 10 past 10, when she arrived, I was pausing between each contraction. It came on really quickly. I was at the car. I remember standing at the front door, holding on to the front door, closing my eyes, waiting for the surge to come, you know, letting it go. Okay, let's go. And into the car. And at this point, they had really, like, started coming really quickly. And the pain was quite intense. Park, so walked up the doors, another contraction, got to the reception. And the woman at reception was like, is this your first baby? No, it's my third. Okay. So she could obviously see that their things were progressing really quickly. I wasn't waiting too long by the time I had to get triage. And I got in there and they said to me, so it was about 20 past 10. And at this point, we're at COVID again. So they weren't allowed in until you were 3 centimetres. So all I wanted to be was 3 centimetres so he could come in. And she, I remember getting, she could see I was in triage. And she said to me, yeah, so you're 3 centimetres. And I was like, is that all? Like, I'm devastated because I'm in, like, these are coming fast, like every 2 minutes. And they're lasting a minute. And she was like, your body has done so much work. Like, I think when we get so focused on centimetres and dilation and those numbers, but there's so much going on. She was like, your cervix is completely thinned out. The baby, and she's like, your body has been putting so much hard work. And I was like, okay, that made me feel. And you, sometimes you just need that one person that says the right thing. Mm-hmm. And she was like, and your partner can come straight in. So up we went. And at this point, in 18 months, they kind of had done up the labor ward and the labor rooms a little bit. So it was a bit more, I want to say, holistic. Like they had a lovely, like it kind of completely fresh, completely white. The lights were dimmed. There was music on. They had gorgeous pictures on, like floral pictures on the walls. Really lovely colours, really calming, like sage, like the kind of the, what we're wearing, that olive-y colour. And yeah, things have progressed really quickly. I got up there, got to meet my midwife. We're saying it's about, by the time we got into the labour suite, it was about 10 past 11. So I was in the hospital about 45 minutes. And yeah, 10 past 11, I remember being, and I remember saying to them, these are coming so quickly. I don't want an epidural this time. I want to just try and see how far I can go. Not that I don't want, but I want to see how far I can go again. I got to 6 centimetres and it failed. So I was actually, it's more than 6 centimetres the last time. So I just want to keep going. I'll do a lot of swaying, a lot of leaning, like kind of really supporting myself up on Tom and my arms wrapped around his neck. And again, there wasn't much he could do for me this time because there was no back rubbing. So he was just letting me do what I needed to do. And I remember saying to them, guys, this is progressing really quickly. And I don't know, the midwife's seen me and she's seen my body language. And you know, they say a woman starts using those primal noises, you know, the mooing and the the, like, those animal type noises suggest that she is kind of transitioning or going into transition. And she's like, right, up onto the bed, we'll do a quick examination. And I was like, really, please, no. And then I was like, no, we'll get up and I'll see where I am so I can keep going and keep pushing myself. And she's like, you're 5 centimeters. And I remember, again, I panicked at this point and I said, this isn't normal. I'm in a lot, like I'm in so much pain, like this is really unbearable. I felt like my stomach was being ripped open, the burning sensation across my C-section scar. I said, I don't feel like this is normal. And she's like, no, like, you're doing amazing. Would you like pain relief? And I was like, yeah, I will take, if this is only 5 centimetres, I will take an epidural, if that's okay. Like, yeah, we'll just ring them and you, we'll give you what you need. So I started on the gas and air at this point. And I remember saying to Tom, they're lying to me. I can't be only 5 centimetres. Do you know when your mind kind of starts going? And I was like, they're lying to me. And he goes, what do you mean they're lying to you? I said, I'm more than 5 centimeters. I have to be. They're lying to me. They're trying to distract me. This gas and air is crap. And he was like, they're just trying to calm me down. And I was kind of really losing myself at this point. And they're like, no, you're fine. You keep going. We're going to get the anaesthetist. She's on her way. And then with that, I said, I'm bearing down, guys. My body's pushing. And they're like, you were just 5 centimeters. And I started to do that grunt and that moan. And I'd never really experienced that with Ella because I had the spinal. And I started to do this moaning that I didn't even know my body could produce. And they're like, okay, okay, let me just check again. She's like, you're 10 centimeters in a 3 minute period. I've gone from, and you hear of this happening, but you don't ever expect it to happen. So within a 3 minute, and I said, you know what? I'm just happy I told them how I felt and how my body was reacting, because something was happening and I was progressing really, really quickly. So she was like, yeah, you're ready to go. And at that point, I was like, so that means I can't get an epidural. And like, you're doing amazing. You can do this. And I had to. There was no going back. I had to do it. So we done it. And at this point, again, it kind of is a bit of a theme. Unfortunately, her heart rate had completely dropped. And the room, they must have pressed a buzzer, because the room just all of a sudden filled with so many people and doctors. And they were saying to me, we need you to cooperate. Not like, we need you to listen and focus now. This baby needs to come now. And I remember just panicking, be like, what's wrong? But I could hear in between the haze of the air, gas and air, I could hear the really low thump, you know, the heartbeat. And I was like, there's something wrong. And they're like, just focus. So they said, do you agree with us intervention? And I was like, you need to do, to get my baby out safely. So she was Kiwi cup. So they didn't have to actually, I had no episiotomy this time, which was brilliant, because I felt like my efforts had worked and stuff, you know, like I'd tried to do the perineal massage and stuff, you know, and the raspberry leaf tea. And I was just happy that there was no episiotomy. I had this little tiny graze or cut, but the pain from having the suction cup with no spinal block epidural, that was intense. And I just remember they got her out. And there was a few moments of worry. She was brought over to the table. And you know that cry, when you're waiting for that cry, it seems like minutes. And we were just waiting for her. And they're like, we're just waiting for her to kind of, you know, respond. She's just having a little bit of difficulty. And she did. And she was fine. She just wasn't happy with what was going on. And she just needed a bit of support. And so I felt like I'd missed out on that skin to skin again. But she got it and I got to latch again. So we were really happy, and she came out 9 pounds 8 ounces. And I just felt so empowered that the first thing I said when the room kind of calmed down and she was fine and the baby doctors had seen her, I just said, I done it with no epidural. I done it. Like, I can't believe I was able to do it. And it was one of those moments of, you're so proud of yourself, and you're so, like, regardless of what way they came, it's just, I done it. I was able to do it. And I just so glad I listened to every minute my body was telling me or my mind was saying there's something going on. And it's just, yeah, it's just a really empowering feeling. Tom got to stay. So she was born 1 hour and 20 minutes after arriving to hospital. So it was, for my second vaginal delivery, I was delighted, you know, like, because Ella was the first really after the cesarean. So I was really happy. And like that, like, I just knew, like, I listened to my body from being at home. And yeah, she was nice and big and healthy. And despite what the doctors are saying, I was able to stick to what my mind and my body and my intuition, like, mother's intuition is amazing, you know, and her gut instinct. And I was just so happy I could speak for myself, because 8 years ago, I couldn't speak for myself. I was like, I was young. It was mentioned so many times how young I was. My experience with Georgia was so far-fetched. Like, you know, it seems like it was a completely different lifetime now, you know, but I was just so content with how everything went. And that was, yeah, that was that experience with Hannah. So it was a lovely experience. Mm. Yeah.
It's going to be such an important episode to share. I know so many of us will be able to relate to so many different parts of your story.
Thank you so much.
And thank you, Jess. If you would like to share your story, you are more than welcome to get in touch over the website irelandsbirthstories.ie, which I have linked in the show notes. Click on the share your story tab, fill in a few details, and I'll get back to you as soon as possible with a date for our chat. I hope you have a good week, and I will chat to you on Monday with a brand new episode.
Hold up. Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.